You do not need to see what a man is doing to know whether it is his vocation. You only need to watch his eyes. A cook mixing a sauce, a surgeon making an initial cut, a clerk completing a bill of lading. They all bear the same rapt expression, forgetting themselves in function. Oh, how beautiful is that eye on object look. So, W.H. Auden. Where does your deepest passion, Frederick Buechner asked, meet the world's greatest need? Where, come morning or evening, do you stand to sing the songs of spirit and the praise of God, to take life as it comes, and to invest yourself in ability, in affability, in availability, at depth? Where, as Julian Norwich asked, is your ownmost self? Where can you find a way to that space and time when you can plan for the worst, hope for the best, then do your most, and leave all the rest? Where is your calling, your vocation? Our lesson from St. Matthew carries us into a part of a journey which takes disciples, students, and makes of them apostles, messengers. It helps them to leave school. You know, change can be frightening. It produces anxiety, especially if you have been, say, in school for a long time, from age 2 or 3 through high school, college, graduate school, and another degree. It can be a little bit anxiety-provoking to think about leaving school. I love the work of Barbara Brown Taylor, especially including her last book, Leaving Church. But maybe her next book would be Leaving School, Disciples Becoming Apostles. You see, sometimes, this perhaps may apply to a few present with us and others listening around the region and across the globe. It may be time to think about pulling up stakes. Oh, everything one learns in school is important. You need every scrap, every morsel, every, speaking biblically, jot and tittle of what you learn as in a bachelor's degree, and particularly if you're heading on to the ministry, what you will learn in a theological degree. There's nothing wasted, nothing lost. Every item, every bit is needed. But where your true calling meets you may be just outside of school. It's happened before. Notice in the gospel today, Jesus first preaches, teaches, and heals and meets us with compassion. Second, he gathers and calls disciples. We recognize that Matthew has circumscribed his mission in a way that Mark and Luke and John do not. He gives the gospel writer gives a list of names that is at a little bit of variance with other such listings, but there is a call and a response. Third, Jesus identifies that not every move into ministry will be successful, that there will be places and times when you will shake the dust from your feet. And then finally, and in composite, the gospel reminds us that there is a discipline at the heart of discipleship, that there is a cost to what we are involved in. And part of that cost, for some of us, our participants whom we especially and personally welcome, who are fellows in the Fund for Theological Education. It may be for a few, one or two or more, that that calling will appear outside of school or after school. For some of you, it'll be in the South, and for some in the North. Now, we envy from these quarters the chances others may have to build a big church in Plano, Texas, to put out a tarmac and build the building where there isn't any ice and there isn't any snow and there are very few blizzards. And you may want to go that direction, but you may want to think, I'm playing with you a little bit here, that you might want to consider going not where you're wanted, but where you're needed. And if that's the case, you may want to come north and build a church at 10 below zero and see 81-year-olds dusting off the car and making their way. I remember when Iva Gorman came to church to the early service in February at about zero on the Fahrenheit scale, and she was angry. She was so angry she could spit nails, as Paul was when he wrote to the Galatians, because he was saying, Galatians 3:28, not that the divisions, religious and economic and gender, that we so prize ought to disappear. He was saying, look, in the orb of the new creation, they are gone. In reality, they are not. So why do you live as if they were? Well, she had that sort of combative feeling. Actually, she was a great feisty person anyway. I had earned my PhD that year. We had celebrated it. She came through the door and said, you know, I'm just not in a worshipful mood. I rented out my second house to a group of graduates, actually they're postdoctoral students. I said, I knew that. I said, yes, they're chemists. I know, I said. And they let the pipes burst and they let the basement flood and I have a skating rink at the ground floor and I'm just not ready to worship. But then she brightened a little bit. This is a humorous story, if you take it so. And she said, you know, I really ought to be a little bit more accepting. I mean, they are academics, and they do have a doctorate, and he did earn a PhD. And then she said, I'll remember it my whole life. He did earn a PhD. You really can't expect much. not with regard to you, Bob. In other words, there is something to be said for understanding, and that's so important. But one of the dangers of the academic life is that I sometimes mistake understanding for overcoming. And Jesus is identified in the Gospel of John as saying, not I have understood the world, but I have overcome the world. And you may find your way at a certain point beyond school, leaving school to your own calling. It has happened before, this movement from understanding to overcoming. Maybe we should remember an older style of ministry, Albert Schweitzer, who was a great scholar. I used his work in the aforementioned PhD. His letters to and from Bultmann that are still on file at the Syracuse University Library. Somebody could write a nice article there one day. He became at a young age, after his quest for the historical Jesus and mysticism of the Apostle Paul, he became the head of a seminary, the principal of an Alsatian theological school, and he was a renowned organist, a Bach expert. But one day he received in the mail a copy of the Paris Missionary Society Journal. And it described the endless need in Central Africa for healing. So he set aside his books and his principalship and his Bach, and he took 7 years of medical study and the next 35 years in ministry to the Powan and Benjabi tribesfolk. And one day later in life, he came to the edge of a river and saw a herd of hippopotami coming across and splashing, and he recognized his deepest calling to express a reverence for life. The kingdom of heaven is at hand when your ownmost self emerges in a vocation. Maybe we should remember Jane Addams. I wish she were in one of our stained glass windows. She ought to have been. 130 years ago, she left the potential to be a school teacher behind. She left school in Rockford, Illinois, and went to Chicago, and there developed one of the lastingly great social ministries in the history of this country, in Hull House. And she developed in what we would call today a feminist mode, a gathering, a development of labor unions, city parks, speeches across the country, in which she regularly said, I quote her, as exactly as I can. The goods that we associate with a life of refinement and cultivation must be made universal if they are to be secure. The good that we secure for ourselves is uncertain, precarious, floating in midair until it is secured for all and made a part of our common life. How I wish Christopher Lash were still alive, he who loved to study Adam's work and said, among other things of her, somewhere in early life, she found a way to release a part of herself which, once released, freed up the rest. And you, in the common ministry, we have been seized by the confession of the church. Otherwise, we would not be here and we would not be listening. Where is your part in that great ministry and mission? Do you love Jesus? Then you must do something for him. Perhaps from this pulpit today we could remember Howard Thurman, who had a habit of leaving school. I mean, he left Boston University and went on to speak around the globe. Before that, he had left Howard University and went on to his church in San Francisco. But earlier, he left the Rochester Theological Seminary. And after his first year, he went to Roanoke, Virginia. I'll give it in his own words to the best of memory. I went to serve for a month while Dr. James and his family went on vacation. The first night in the parsonage, the phone rang. It was a nurse from the hospital. Is Dr. James in? I explained he was gone. Well, he's the hospital chaplain, and we have a man dying here, and we need a minister. Are you a minister? In one kaleidoscopic moment, I was at the crossroads of an old decision. A decision about vocation had to be made, and all of the ambivalence of my life and calling were before me. And finally, I said, yes, I am a minister. Well, come quickly, or you'll be too late. In haste, I went, leaving my Bible at the home. I went into the hospital and down the hallway, and there was the dread curtain. And the nurse guided me and placed me on the other side of the bed. The man looked at me and said, do you have something to say to a dying man? If you do, please do so with haste. I bowed my head. No words came. At last, I reached deep into myself and lifted it, felt like I was reaching all the way to heaven, and offered my prayer, concluding with an amen. We opened our eyes at the same time. Thank you, he said. I understand. He died with his hand in mine. Where does your deepest calling meet the world's greatest need? Perhaps today on Father's Day we can remember those who have given themselves to us in mentoring, for those who have recently lost their father and are remembering in some memorial in grief. We also lost our dad not too long ago, and we can join you. It's good to leave school once in a while. In the spring of 1973, six of us left college to come to a cottage in upstate New York. My dad was waiting for us there. We drove across Route 80 in one of those, well, it's kind of like a boat looking back. There were six strapping college students, and we had plenty of room to spare. Across Route 80 we went in the rain, and then With the slippery roads, we went way off the road, tumbled down a hillside. I had brought my sister Cynthia a bucket with two lab mice from the school that she wanted, and they were, with the rest of the luggage, thrown and strewn. We finally made it back onto the highway and crawled along without windshield wipers now to Route 81 and north. And where we had were supposed to have arrived at midnight, we got in just at dawn. And all night long, my dad had been tending the fire. You do need a fire sometimes, even in the springtime in the north. And waiting for us. And we arrived, and he hosted us at a beautiful breakfast. And then I remember, as he was tending the fire and getting ready to go to work, we had left school, I remember listening to him singing, "Every time I feel the Spirit moving in my heart, I will pray. Every time I feel the Spirit moving in my heart, I will pray." Who told you who you truly are? Where is your depth in passion and compassion? You know, you don't need to see what a man is doing to know whether it's his vocation. You only need to watch his eyes. A cook mixing a sauce, a surgeon making an initial incision, a clerk preparing a bill of lading, all wear the same rapt expression, forgetting themselves in the function. Oh, how beautiful it is, that eye on object look.